if you would please turn with me to Esther chapter 2. As you're turning there, let me begin by saying the Old Testament contains a lot of miraculous events and divine perspective into the lives of men and women in ancient history. And that's one of the reasons we're drawn to it, is because we can see those things in Scripture. But Esther is different from the rest of the books, the historical books in the Old Testament, because it does not once mention the name of God. It doesn't offer his perspective or describe any miraculous events. Instead, this book is a narrative of, well, completely ordinary events. They're certainly full of dramatic tension, and there's certainly irony in this narrative, but everything that happens here is completely ordinary. The people here are completely ordinary, and they're just responding to each other in ordinary, understandable ways. And yet, it's because of that, because we know that the rest of the Old Testament does contain divine perspective, does contain us being able to see what God is doing and how God is working, because God seems so absent in this book, it is then that we can know, he's really working, because that's how we act today. Today, we don't get the opportunity to know what God thinks of our lives or know what God is specifically doing in a particular circumstance that's going on in your life. You just have to live wisely. You just have to take the circumstances that you're in and the gifts and talents that you've been given, and you need to seek to be wise and trust the Lord with the outcome. That's exactly what's going on in this book here. Esther and Mordecai have to do that. And to steal from Craig's analogy, when he was teaching the guys last Wednesday, the pieces are being moved into position to thwart Satan's scheme against the Jews. And it all starts when the king of Persia, Ahasuerus or Xerxes, loses his queen. In chapter 1, we saw that he holds this massive banquet, likely in order to bring in all of the officials because he's preparing for a campaign against Greece. His father attempted to conquer Greece and failed, so now he's going to give it a shot. So he brings everybody in, he has this banquet, and in a drunken lack of judgment, he attempts to show off his queen, show off how beautiful she is to the rest of the people that are there, and Vashti says no. And so, in an attempt to save face, Ahasuerus exiles her and also proclaims a decree that perpetuates male chauvinism by saying, all right, all you wives, you need to listen to your husbands from the standpoint of you need to obey them, because if you don't, then, well, see what happened between me and Vashti. I exiled her. She's done. And then he marches off to Greece. He builds a bridge across the Hellespont, which is a very interesting story. And then the Spartans sacrifice themselves at Thermopylae in order to buy time for the rest of the Greek city-states. And they manage to eventually defeat him. And so, knowing the campaign is probably lost, instead of staying to see the campaign seem through, he slinks off back to Persia to lick his wounds. And what is a man to do after a long, hard day at work, you know, a long, hard military campaign when he comes home? Well, he needs to drown his sorrows, drown them in food, drown them in wine, drown them in his beautiful wife. Uh-oh, wait a minute. He doesn't have a wife anymore. He exiled her. What's he going to do? So we come to chapter 2. The title of this message is The King's Search for a Queen. And throughout this chapter, hopefully we will see that God can accomplish his purposes through the gifts and talents he's given to those faithful to him. I'll say that again. God can accomplish his purposes through the gifts and talents that he has given to those faithful to him. He doesn't have to work through miraculous means to accomplish his purposes. If you are a Christian, hopefully you can learn from this that you need to be trusting God and make use of how he has made and gifted you to further his will in the midst of non-miraculous circumstances. So, we are going to go through this chapter in sections. I'll read a section of scripture, We'll discuss it, and then we'll move on to the next section, since this chapter is so large. So starting in verse 1. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's attendants who served him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that he may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti." And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly. So first, our first point is A, the servants form the plan. Servants form the plan. Verse 1, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. So after the events of chapter 1, when it says after these things, there's actually quite a bit of a time gap because Ahasuerus goes off to attempt to conquer Greece, which takes a few years. And he doesn't really need to bother with worrying about the queen that he has just exiled because he's off fighting a war. But then he comes home, and he realizes what he's done and the effects of it. He recalls that anger doesn't pay. It may feel good to either blow up on someone or clam up on someone and use it to fuel action against them or against other people. But when the dust has settled, you just look back at the destruction that you've just caused. And that's what Ahasuerus finds out. He should have known the truth of Proverbs 15:18 that says, "A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, pain, destruction, but the slow to anger calms a dispute." And just right off the bat, as a quick side application, how are you when it comes to your temperament? Are you easily angered? Are you hot-tempered? Or are you slow to anger? You can tell by the stability of your relationships. Is there strife in your relationships? Are there problems in your relationships that you're choosing to ignore because you're the one who caused them because of your hot-temperedness? Or when you see problems in your relationships, are you seeking to resolve them? Are you seeking to calm them? Are you seeking to make peace? Ahasuerus does not do any of those things. He faces the consequences of his anger. He no longer has a queen, and he needs one. Now, an important distinction, he's not looking for, he doesn't need a queen because he needs sexual pleasure. He has a harem. He has a ton of women that he could do that with. No, he specifically needs a queen there in the midst of his organization, and apparently Vashti was a good one, and so now he needs a new one. And fascinatingly enough, it seems that he doesn't do anything about it. He comes home, he realizes that she's gone, and he just apparently mopes, because it doesn't say, "So then the king said," or "the king had this idea," or "this the king made this decree." No, it says, "Then the king's attendants who served him." Apparently, he was so distraught and so disappointed, probably also bummed out that he'd also just lost his war, that the servants get so irritated that he's not doing anything that they come up with a plan for him. Now, it may have been that he was planning this all along, and he knows that if he waits long enough, people will come up with ideas for him. But either way, he doesn't come up with this idea himself. Verse 2, "Then the king's attendants who served him said, 'Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint overseers in all the provinces for his kingdom, that they may gather every beautiful young virgin to the citadel of Susa, to the harem, into the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let their cosmetics be given to them. Then let the young lady who pleases the king be queen in place of Vashti.'" They come up with a pretty simple plan. King needs a beautiful queen. All right. Let's grab every single beautiful young virgin that's in the entire nation and have a contest. We'll pick from them. And then it says, "And the matter pleased the king, and he did accordingly." And I'll bet it did please the king. This plan did not please the queen. This plan appeals to the king's need. He needs a queen. appeals to his ego, only the most beautiful queen will do, and appeals to his lust. We're going to grab every single one that we can find. So, if you were a beautiful young virgin living in Persia, and this decree goes out, you had not just won the sweepstakes if you were beautiful enough for this decree. You would be ripped from your home. This was not something where oh, I think I'm beautiful enough, I'm going to volunteer. No. If they deem you beautiful enough, you are ripped from your home. You are dragged back to the palace, and you're going to spend the rest of your life there, whether you become queen or not. That's what's going on here. And Ahasuerus has the power to do so, so he just goes ahead and he does it. Acting in complete disregard for what that's going to do. Can you imagine what is going to be happening in all of these households throughout the nation where daughters are being just snagged and brought back to the capital for the king's pleasure? The amount of pain, the amount of sadness, and the king doesn't care. He's acting purely in his own self-interest, which is completely contrary to how Christians ought to act. Philippians 2, 3 through 4. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourselves. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. So a bit of more side application here. Do you attempt to use the authority that you do have just to get what you want instead of trying to benefit other people? Many of you have younger siblings, and with that you sometimes have a bit of authority there, do you not? Do you attempt to just use that for your own gain? Try to keep them out of the way so you can do your own thing? Try to just use that power for yourself? Or are you actually trying to use it in a beneficial way to help your parents, to help your younger siblings? Or maybe if you don't have any power at all, do you then look for manipulation instead? You try to use manipulation since you don't have authority in order to get people to do what you want. You're not thinking about them at all. You're just thinking about how you can use them to get things for yourself. Well, that's not what a Christian ought to do. That's not how they ought to act. And if you do act that way, you're no different from this king who's just doing what he wants because he has the power to do so. And so he's going to use all these people for his own gain. So then, after this decree is sent out, we are introduced to two more important characters in this narrative. Verse 5. Now, there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now, the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about, when the command and decree of the king were heard and many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa into the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. So our next point is that Esther is taken. Esther is taken. So first we're introduced to Mordecai, verse 5. Now there was at the citadel in Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives, who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. The exile is mentioned because, as you may remember, there were three deportations. There was the first deportation, which was most of the royal family and officials there. There was the second deportation, which was the captains of the armies, the great men of valor, all the skilled craftsmen. And there was the third and final deportation, where Nebuchadnezzar just destroyed everything and yanked everybody to Babylon. And Mordecai is of that second deportation. So that means that he and his family, he is descendant from some group of either skilled craftsmen or some group of important prominence that was originally in Israel's military. And that's going to become important later on for us to understand why he is in the current occupation that he's in, which we'll see at the end of this chapter. So that's why it mentions that first. But more importantly, Mordecai is a Benjamite, a descendant, it says, all the way at the end, of Kish. And Kish was the ancestor of Saul, King Saul, who had disobeyed God's command to kill all of the Amalekites. This will also become important later in the narrative. Keep your eyes peeled for that. But even more importantly than that, most importantly, Mordecai is a Jew. He is a member of God's chosen ethnic people. And as a reminder, whether a Jew was faithful to God or not, they were still regarded by all the people that saw them, and they still even regarded themselves as someone who was associated with God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There was no separation from that. Mordecai's ethnicity is important to this story because his people are going to be threatened, which means God's people are going to be threatened. And so just the mere mention of the reality that Mordecai is a Jew brings God into the story, albeit in an indirect way. This is about the Jewish people, so this is about God and what he's going to do. Verse 7, he was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it came about when the command and decree of the king were heard, and many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa into the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. So, Esther is a younger cousin of Mordecai, young enough to be raised by him. She's an orphan. And the key element to note, because the text brings it up, is that she was, quote, beautiful of form and face. And why is this important? Why does the author choose to bring this up? Well, because the king's men are searching for beautiful women. If Esther is not beautiful by their standards, this story doesn't happen. Which brings up an important point. God gave Esther her beauty for a purpose, to fulfill his will in the events of this narrative. Only a notably beautiful woman was going to get in. And so, by application, young ladies, and also young men, this means that your physical form and your talents that you may possess are not an accident. Furthermore, it means that your physical form and your talents were given to you and are not inherent to you. You have been specially created by God to look the way you do, to be capable in the ways that you are, with God's full knowledge and approval for a particular role that God would have you to fulfill. So, don't be arrogant if you possess those things. The world, Ahasuerus, the servants who came up with this plan, they are enamored with beauty and talent. They love it. But God made them not as something to be gloried in, but as something to be used. Something to be used for his glory and not for someone's own glory. They need to be used properly. Proverbs 31:30, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. But a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. This isn't to say that charm and beauty are sinful. Charm and beauty are awful things that you shouldn't desire, you shouldn't use. Just simply says, you can have something beautiful or something talented in your life that God has given you, that God, how God has made you in that way. But if you don't fear the Lord, it doesn't matter. It's really not that important because it's not going to amount to anything eternal. So by application, it can be very easy to flaunt your looks or your talents, to use them to have influence on other people, and then to use those people to get what you want, to manipulate and control others. But God did not make you to glorify yourself. He made you to glorify him. And that's what he made Esther for as well. So Esther, in this narrative, is deemed beautiful by the people out searching to obey the decree and is taken to the palace harem under the charge of a eunuch, Haggai. So now we come to verse 9. Now, the young lady pleased him, that is Haggai, and found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. Every day, Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. So we have our next point. Esther hides her heritage. Esther hides her heritage. Verse 9, now the young lady pleased him, that is Haggai, and found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and food, gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace, and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. So we first see that Esther was pleasing to Haggai to the point that he favored her above the other women that were being brought in. Something about her made him decide that out of all of those women, this was the one, or one of a select few, that he was now going to try and make queen. And this is likely not just because of her looks at this point. We'll see why in a few verses, but it seems that Esther is not only beautiful, but she is also wise in her conduct. And that's what draws Haggai's eye. After all, he's literally in charge of the most beautiful woman, by the words of the decree, the most beautiful woman in the entire nation. So he's dealing with nothing but beautiful people. So there needs to be more than that if you're going to stand out in front of this eunuch. So apparently something does. But next, we are provided with some crucial information that's relevant to the unfolding plot. Verse 10, Esther did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had instructed her that she should not make them known. So, this may cause a question. Wait a minute. If Esther was being raised by Mordecai, who we know is a Jew, and later on the narrative, everybody else knows Mordecai is a Jew, then how on earth do we get to a point where people don't know that Esther is a Jew? How does that work? Well, she was an orphan. So people don't know that her mother and father were Jewish. They just know she's being raised by a Jewish man. They don't know the connection there. So that would be why she would actually be able to succeed in not telling people that she's a Jew and people not knowing that she's a Jew. So even though Mordecai is a Jew and people know that she's his adopted daughter, that does not mean that they know. But the question becomes, okay, but why hide it? What's the point of this? Why would Mordecai tell Esther to do this? Well, don't turn there, but the answer will be, and you can write this down, in Esther 9:6 and Esther 9:15. Spoiler alert, Haman enacts an edict where all of the people that hate Jews have a day where they can go out and kill, slaughter, annihilate, and pillage all of the Jews that are in their area. That's what the edict's going to be. And then later on, at the end of the story, Esther and Mordecai successfully persuade the king to enact a counter-edict where the Jews have permission to defend themselves, and they can go attack all of the enemies that hate them and want to kill them. And even with that counter-edict, there are people in Persia who still hate the Jews enough that even that they know that the king has given express permission to the Jews to respond back in self-defense, there are still at least 800 people in the capital city itself that want to still go out and kill the Jews and attempt to. Now they fail because verses 6 and verses 15 explain to us that those people die. The Jews are able to kill them. But it goes to show that anti-Semitism is incredibly strong in Persia right now, especially in the capital city. And Esther is no longer under the protection of her adopted father. She has been taken to the palace. She has no protection in that way. And so Mordecai wants to make sure she stays as safe as possible and tells her, don't tell anyone that you're a Jew. Because if they find that out, it's not going to be pretty. In verse 11, every day Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared. Mordecai can't visit her because she now belongs to the king. She's now his wife, essentially. And another important point in the narrative to know about Persian culture, you don't touch the king's stuff, and you especially don't touch the king's women. If you do, capital punishment. So Mordecai has to deal with simply walking in front of the court and exchanging messages with Esther through a mediator. But it goes to show that now, even though she's gone, he still cares for her and still loves her and wants to make sure that she's doing okay. She's worried about his adopted daughter, who's just been taken from him for this beauty contest, of which we now learn the rules. Verse 12. Now, when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification, were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. The young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shagaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king unless the king, go into the king unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So we have our next point. The author explains the rules. The author explains the rules. Verse 12. Now, when the turn of each young lady came to go into King Ahasuerus, after the end of her 12 months under the regulations for the women, for the days of their beautification were completed as follows: 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and the cosmetics for women. So, the longest beautification regimen you could dream of is happening. Some have looked at this and been like, there is no way that they decided to spend 12 months on these women to make them look as beautiful as possible. And I just look at this narrative and I go, really? You're questioning that? This guy had a 180-day banquet to show off how awesome he is, to show off how rich he is, and how powerful he is. I mean, he can wait a year for every single beautiful woman that comes into his palace to be as beautiful as possible, how he likes, so that he can enjoy it to the fullest. This is the kind of guy we're talking about. He lays no expense to waste. He is going to use everything he can for everything to be as extravagant, magnanimous, amazing as he can possibly get it. And it's also possible that the regimen for each woman began as they were being brought into the palace. Because think about this. Remember, the decree goes out to all of the provinces in Persia. These people did not have planes. These people did not have trains. These people did not have cars. They had horses. They had carts. So it's going to take a while to get all of these people into the capital. So probably what's happening is, as you come in, then the beautification process starts. And then, once the first woman is good to go, then the rest of the process starts. It goes like that. All about extravagance. Verse 13. The young lady would go into the king in this way. Anything that she desired was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go into the king unless the king delighted in her, and she was summoned by name. Sadly, this is not an Emperor's New Groove situation. You know, line all the girls up and be like, hate your hair, not likely, yikes, let me guess, you have a great personality. That's sadly not what's going on here. It's a lot worse than that. If you are one of the beautiful young women who gets brought to the palace, and you have all that beautification done, then you're able to bring anything with you that you want, any skills that you think you might have, and then you have one shot, one night. And if the king is not impressed with you, you then get to live with all of the rejects in the second harem for the rest of your life. So, once it starts, each and every night until he runs out, Ahasuerus sleeps with a different woman trying to find the one he likes the best. Verse 15. Now, when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what Hegai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So we have our next point. Esther is chosen as queen. Now in the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, came to go into the king. She did not request anything except what Hegai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the women, advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. This verse is why I'm convinced that people saw more in Esther than just another pretty face. She was wise and respectful to authority. She didn't try to impress on her own. She didn't come into this and be like, all right, well, I'll figure this out. I'm pretty, I can do this. No, instead, she sought out advice from Hegai, the eunuch who's in charge of all these beautiful people, who's in charge of what the king does with all these beautiful people, and so he knows everything, and he knows what the king will like best. And so she goes to him to ask him for advice, and he tells her, this is what you should do, this is what you should take with you. And so she does that. She doesn't just rely on herself. She's wise in this way. And furthermore, this is the second time that Esther is said to have found favor, which is not by accident. Keep looking for it throughout the story. It's reminiscent of Daniel finding favor with the Babylonian official and Joseph finding favor. And this is clearly another instance of seeing God in the narrative. We're so used to seeing that people have found favor with others in Old Testament narrative that we know God is working in that. He's using that person and he's using what he's given them, but nonetheless, he's the one who's at work. And he's clearly at work through Esther's beauty to get her into the contest, but also through her wise conduct to continue on and to have a shot at this. And just as a brief pause, let's consider also, Esther's in a situation where it's not like she can say no to this whole thing. She can't just be like, I'm not doing that. No, she's been brought in and she's been made his wife, essentially. She and all the other women that get brought in. And so she doesn't then just throw up her hands and just be like, all right, fine, well, whatever happens, happens. No, she thinks, well, since I'm in this situation, I might as well do everything I can to actually win this contest, because if I do, maybe some good might come out of it if I am queen as opposed to one of these other women. So she is making the most of her situation and making the most of what God has given her in this very strange and yet ordinary circumstance. When it comes to it, ordinary meaning non-miraculous. There's nothing astounding going on. It's just simply men are doing what they want, and Esther is trying to respond to that. So then, verse 16. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Ah, success! Esther finds favor and kindness with Ahasuerus by God's hand through her circumstances and wise conduct. And Ahasuerus then, in the next few verses, in his signature move, throws a banquet. Verse 18. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. He's just laying it on. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. So we have our next point. Esther is obedient. Esther is obedient. So first, the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and his servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave his gifts according to the king's bounty. When the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Another banquet! Hooray! Can't get enough of these. And furthermore, it would seem that Ahasuerus pursues another long period of pleasure based on the fact that it says the virgins were gathered together a second time. And we'll discuss Mordecai at the gate in the next few verses for the sake of time, because it mentions that he's at the gate in later verses. So we'll address that there. But first, let's look at verse 20. Verse 20, Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, even as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther did what Mordecai told her, as she had done when under his care. So even though she is now queen, and even though she is no longer has to answer to Mordecai, who's just an official, Esther still has respect for and gives weight to what Mordecai has to say. He still believes that she's in danger, and so tells her to remain quiet about her heritage until the right moment, which will be incredibly important later on in the narrative. But I think it's very important for us to notice this as well in Esther's wise conduct. She is someone who does not blow off authority. She is someone who responds respectfully to authority, even authority that doesn't necessarily have as significant influence as it used to. Because notice it says, Esther did what Mordecai told her as she had done when under her care. So she was this way when he was her adopted father and she was his adopted daughter. And when she moved out of that into her own, she still has a respect for him and an obedience for him. And if you, later on, if you ever spend any time reading commentaries on the book of Esther, you may find that a lot of people, when they come to this book, think that this is a story in which Mordecai and Esther are not being God-honoring. This is just a story, and God is working through these people in order to accomplish his purposes, but there's nothing really to be admired about the character of Mordecai and Esther. And I think with the reading of this, just with the reading of this text, that does not seem to be true at all, based on, even now so far, how they have conducted themselves. Both Mordecai seeking to care for his adopted daughter, and Esther choosing to be obedient when she has no reason to. Esther choosing to be respectful to authority when she definitely has, as it were, no reason to when it comes to what these authorities have done to her and to her family. These two individuals seem to be wise in a godly way. So, Esther has been appointed queen, and now we only need one final piece moved into place. Verse 21. In those days, while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials, from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. But the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther. and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now, when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they were both hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. So we have our final point, Mordecai saves the king. Now it says, sitting at the king's gate. Anytime you see in the Old Testament the phrase, the king's gate, sitting at the king's gate, was at the king's gate, or, you know, at the city's gate, the gate is where business was done. The gate is where both commercial and political events took place. And it would seem that Mordecai is in some position of importance here in the capital city of Persia, doing business of some kind, either commercial or political. And it's most likely political because this plot comes from two of the king's officials, from those who guarded the door. What guarded the door of what? Guarded the king's door. They were bodyguards to the king, because at some point, the king has to sleep. You have to sleep at some point. And when you're sleeping, you're most vulnerable. And so you better make sure that you have people that you trust who are guarding your bedchamber door. Because if you are a king, people want to kill you so that they can be king instead. So being a bodyguard was very, very important. And being a bodyguard very close to the king in this way means that Mordecai must have been in a high enough position that was important enough that he either had eyes and ears, or he had other people that he communicated with to where he could find out about such a plot that's this close to the king. And he finds out about it, and just consider for a moment, you're in Mordecai's shoes. You're living here in this city, and the king has just issued a decree that has taken your adopted daughter from you to be his queen or just one of his concubines forever, for the rest of her life. You're never going to see her again. I mean, if you heard about this attempt to murder the man who has done this to you, maybe just let it happen. Don't do anything about it. Let's see what happens. No. Mordecai has respect enough for this awful, completely egotistical man and chooses to save his life from this plot. Verse 22, but the plot became known to Mordecai, and he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. Now when the plot was investigated and found to be so, they, that is Bigthan and Teresh, were both hanged on a gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. And when it talks about gallows, kind of as Justin talked about a little while back, when the Persian king was threatening all those guys that wanted to stop the building in Israel, this is not a hanging gallows. This is a giant stake in the ground. And what you do is you take this person. That's what it talks about when it's talking about gallows. And so it's not pretty. And that form of execution, keep that in mind, store that away, because that's also going to become very important later on in the narrative. And it's presented to us here. And after that, after the execution, after the plot is foiled, there's no pomp and circumstance, apparently. Maybe there is some pomp and circumstance for Esther, because Esther is the one that tells the king. But because Esther tells the king that Mordecai was the one that found out about this, then Mordecai's name gets written into the book of Chronicles about he's the guy that found this out, that saved the king's life. That's also going to be very important later on in this narrative. Keep that in mind. So, Mordecai is in a very different position than Esther is. And yet, he has specific talents and skills in the position that he's in, and he has been thrust into these circumstances. and he chooses to act wisely. In both Esther and Mordecai's cases, they were people with particular talents and gifts that began reacting to changes in circumstances, and by acting with wisdom, they furthered God's purposes. Because don't forget, Mordecai and Esther have no idea what the ending is going to be. They have no idea what God is doing. They have absolutely no idea as of now about this plan that Haman is going to enact. They don't know what's going on behind the scenes. They have no idea. They're just like, okay, I got grabbed. I am now in the palace. Okay, my daughter just got grabbed, and oh my gosh, someone's trying to kill the king. What am I going to do? And they have to act wisely. God doesn't tell them anything. God doesn't give them a word. They don't get to see what's going on. They have to act wisely as best they can with the knowledge that they have. Just like you and me. So, in the same way that they are just responding and living as wisely as they can, trusting God for the outcome, so should you. Hopefully, you can take both this chapter and continual chapters as we go on to be reminded that even in the midst of sometimes insane circumstances, God has made you the way you are in such a way that you can accomplish his purposes in such a way that you are glorifying him through whatever it is that you do and whatever circumstance you find yourself in. Even if you don't know what's going on, even if you don't know what the end is going to be, you can trust God that he is working out his plan for your good and for his glory. Let's pray. Dear Lord, thank you for today. Thank you for this time that we can look into this narrative to see you working behind the scenes in the midst of these circumstances and how we ought to emulate these individuals who are just seeking to be wise and make the most of their situation. And you are then using their faithfulness to accomplish your plans later on, to help protect and save your people in this narrative. And I pray that we would remember that in the same way, even though we don't know what's going on in our lives, we can trust you. We should not take what you have given to us for granted. Instead, we should seek to use it for your honor and glory. In your name, amen.